The goal of the ERA amendment is to affirm rights that shouldn't be denied based on one's sex. Some say that's redundant, especially in Illinois, where the state constitution has been pretty clear.
The Supreme Court has really taken gender equality pretty seriously.
That's U of I Law School Dean Vic Amar. We talk more about the vote for the ERA. A few summers ago, Toledo's water supply was endangered by an algae bloom. Now, environmental groups are worried this summer will be a banner year for toxic algae blooms. And Muslims around Illinois begin observing Ramadan tonight. It's a time of fasting, prayer, and giving to charity.
The fact that we help the poor is a byproduct of our taqwa. Taqwa is this word that refers to Allah consciousness, being conscious and being aware of the existence of Allah in your life.
We talked to Zakat Chicago and a few imams about charitable giving this Ramadan. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tonight, after sundown, Muslims all around the world will begin celebrating the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Many of us know that that means for about 30 days. Many Muslims will fast during the day, but there's much more than just not eating or drinking. It's also an important time for charitable giving, including a specific form of charity called zakat. To help us learn more about this concept and its role in Ramadan, we're joined now by Imam Syed Baig from the Islamic Center of Quad Cities in Moline. Imam Baig, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Nyla, for having me.
And in studio with me here in Evanston is Mohammed Kaiser-Rudin, the chairman of Zakat Chicago, and Dilnaz Warich, who's chair of the Interfaith and Outreach Committee of the Muslim Community Center in Chicago. Thank you for being here with me as well.
Pleased to be here.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having us.
Imam, I wonder if we can start with Ramadan itself. Can you help us with a quick definition of this time of year and an explanation of the month?
Well, Ramadan is the fourth pillar of Islam of fasting. It's the ninth month of Islamic calendar. It's a very special month for Muslims all around the world. It's the month where every day we fast from dawn till sunset, abstaining from eating or drinking or any marital relationship. The focus is that a person can introspect their lives and try to attain piety, as God says in the Quran, that fasting has been prescribed on you, just like how it was prescribed on the previous nations, so that the people can get closer to Allah, so they can become pious and get God's conscience.
Dilnaz, what do you think are some common misconceptions around Ramadan as you're listening to the Imam explain a little bit about it?
Sure. Thanks for asking that question. As an educator, I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, I'm sure students don't have to do certain days of fasting, or I'm sure you, if you're very thirsty, you can go ahead and get a drink of water. But it's really the intentionality you have during that time, which is very important. So when we say dawn until sunset, in Chicagoland, it is about 17 hours. And if you are of age, which is, you know, and you're healthy, which is between after puberty and you're not taking medication, you do need to fast from dawn until sunset. And if there's a reason that you're a traveler, if you're pregnant, or if you're on medication, then you are able to not fast and you have those allocations. But it's fascinating. A lot of our students that are in schools throughout the country will definitely have their teachers and their administration be their allies, and they will make sure that they contact those administration. And the school really supports the students during these difficult times as well. So it's making sure that we're connecting with our principals and our administration and making them an ally for these students.
Right. For younger students, most college students are finished, so most of our college students are done. But for our high school and secondary, and basically any of our elementary students, they still have about a month of school left here.
Sure, definitely. And this is a difficult time during finals, during, you know, conference time for a lot of the sports. So we do have students that are still playing sports and fasting the 17 hours. And a lot of research has been shown where if you're an athlete, you actually perform better fasting because there's so much you're giving up of yourself, but you're also making yourself the best individual during this time.
And Mom, I mentioned that charity is a big component of Ramadan. Why is that?
Well, charity is actually the third pillar of Islam, that is zakat, where a person would give from their savings, 2.5% from their savings. But during Ramadan, Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he was a very generous person, but he was very much more generous in the month of Ramadan. There's a special sort, special kind of charity in the month of Ramadan, which is to be given. It's called Fitrah, the fasting charity to those who are in need. And if you think of the concept in home economics that, that is often taught to children or even adults, parents usually teach their children, don't go shopping when you're hungry because you tend to fill your cart, things with which you don't need. So the reverse concept is what is understood in Islam, where actually when you are fasting and when you are hungry and you're abstaining from food and drink, this is a moment you should go out and give give out to people who are in need. Understanding fasting is it's a voluntary act of not eating and drinking. At that moment, of course, you do get hungry. And that hunger is, again, as I mentioned, is a voluntary act. But there are people who are going through the same process involuntarily. They have no choice but to starve. So I think in the month of Ramadan, the connection of charity, the connection of giving to those who are in need is very important, because now you are feeling, you're experiencing the hunger and then realizing that there are actually people who are going through this very same process, but they're going through this without any choice. So it, it makes a person very humble and allows them to introspect in their own self to what all the gifts of God they have, from food, from family, from shelter, and so on and so forth, and to acknowledge that, especially with regards to hunger, the others who are going through this process without any choice, you should, you go out and understand or feel some sort of sympathy towards them, and then go beyond that to actually help them and give something in charity to those who are in need.
That's Aman Saad Baig. He's with the Islamic Center of Quad Cities, on the line with us from Moline. Here with me is also Mohammed Kaiser-Rudin, who's chairman of Zakat Chicago. Mohammed, can you explain a little bit more? The Imam was just telling us a little bit about Zakat as a specific form of charity during Ramadan. Can you explain a little bit more about that and what you all do?
Yeah, let me say that charity is a very broad concept in Islam. It's not just giving the money or financial help. But even, for example, there is a harmful object lying on the road that people can stumble over and fall. If you remove that, that's a form of charity. And even to the extent that you're meeting with your friend with a smile on your face, that's also charity, because you put your friend in good mood. So charity is that broad a concept. Zakat is a very specific form of charity. This, it is so specific that it does not apply to income. A person can be making $1 million per year, there will be no zakat for him. However, if the person has saved money that he has not needed for a full year, then zakat applies on that. So it says that, okay, you did not need this money, and it was, money was, all possessions are blessings of God in our concept. And so you have had something that you had not needed for a full year, so just take out 2.5% of that.
From your savings then?
From the savings and liquid assets, and there are different forms in fixed assets also. There is some charity. There are different rules and regulations. But for simple purposes, if somebody has $1,000 that he had not needed one full year, only $25 of that will be given in a charity. On the other hand, if somebody has saved $1 million all through the year, he did not need it, he would have to give $25,000 from that as zakat.
And you all at Zakat Chicago last year raised more than $500,000 during this time of year.
We raised about $650,000. Zakat Chicago has been in operation in the Chicago area for 15 years. And every year we've been increasing our name recognition, and as people recognize what we are doing, it give more and more money to us. And so we, Zakat Chicago is a very special organization also. We operate on the principle of local collection and local distribution. That charity collected from people living in the metropolitan Chicago area, we use it for the needy people within the metropolitan Chicago area.
Like what programs did you help last year then?
We have several programs like emergency needs. People have were not able to pay their rent or gas bill, electric bill. We pay that. We pay to food pantries. People can come and go there and collect food. Food basket program. Education program, when somebody, you know, cannot pay afford to pay the tuition in Sunday school and all that, we pay for that. Healthcare, we pay for that. Refugee assistance, we pay for that. So there are, you know, probably a dozen different categories in which we spend the zakat.
And so someone can apply to you? Is that how it works? You all partner with organizations, not individuals.
It is not individual that apply to Zakat Chicago, but organizations who have established programs of food pantry, established programs of distributing food baskets or anything like that. Then they apply. And we'll review their application and find it very legitimate and do some due diligence on it to make sure that it will be properly used. We take zakat as a trust. The people are required to pay the zakat, and there are very specific categories in which zakat can be spent. So as a trustee of other people's zakat, we have to be very careful and make sure that it is utilized in the very proper category that should be utilized, and also there is no wastage or anything like that. So we do due diligence of all the organizations who apply to us for zakat.
And Imam Beg, how does it work for you at the Islamic Center of Quad Cities in Moline? Are you also distributing out to the community there?
Yeah, so Quad Cities, we are far away from the Chicago metropolitan area. It's a small community of the four cities, right on Mississippi. So we do very similar. We collect. We have two massages here, two Islamic centers. So both work in hand together. We collect the money of zakat, and those who are needy within the community are the ones who are the first recipients of the zakat and the sadaqah. And we are also involved with the local food pantries and feeding the homeless and the. And the needies within the community.
And Dilnaz, thanks for that, Imam. Dilnaz, this is also an opportunity for interfaith giving as well. It sounds like we're partnering with other interfaith organizations.
Sure. So because I'm associated with the Muslim Community Center in Chicago, this is probably what happens at every single mosque without our state within our country as well. This time during month of Ramadan, most mosques definitely open their doors to their neighbors, to their friends, to their coworkers to make sure that they're coming in understanding about Ramadan. We're having a warm meal together. We're understanding each other's faiths. So this Thursday at the Muslim Community Center in Chicago, we are doing an iftar where we're understanding an organization called the Institutes of Social Policy and Understanding. What is the research saying about American Muslims? What is the data being collected about as far as socioeconomic level professions for different American Muslims? But along with zakat, it's not just receiving a... the recipient isn't just receiving a monetary amount, but it's also very important that they're getting the wraparound services, that they're getting the mental wellness that they need. Because when you give someone just a certain amount of funds, it's a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid that can easily be removed, but it's making sure that they get all the wraparound services to pull them through to the next year, to make sure that they feel supported, have friends, they've got contacts, they can come back, they understand about healthy eating, they understand about their health and wellness. So it's the entire wraparound services that they get as well.
And Dilnaz, you mentioned that's a little bit about the charitable services. Thank you all for explaining that. You also mentioned iftar. That's an opportunity. I was going to ask, with your work as an outreach with other faiths, for people who aren't Muslim but want to learn more, what are ways they can get involved during Ramadan? Iftar is one of them.
Sure. So if you go onto the websites of any of these mosques, they'll definitely have a time or a date where they are having a breaking of the fast. So iftar is at sunset. So please do look at different websites of the mosque and go and contact the mosque and go to the iftar and understand a little bit more about the commonalities between Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, the three Abrahamic faiths. So just like we fast and we have the month of Ramadan, the Jewish community has Yom Kippur and they fast for 24 hours. The Christian community has Lent and they're giving up something that's very near and dear to them. And I think these are all ways of building relationships between communities and us getting to know each other as neighbors and friends. And when we talk about fasting, and we're also talking talking about zakat and charitable giving, we also need to understand this is something that's just not happening in the Muslim community. So the Jewish community is definitely doing tzedakah and giving of their entire savings and their earning of 10%. And the Christian community is doing that as well with tithings, and they're giving 10% of their savings as well.
Before we go, we just have about a minute or two left, but if people have questions during Ramadan till dusk, I wanted to ask you, if people are maybe shy or uncomfortable about asking questions, what's your advice to them?
That's a great question. I feel like building a relationship before asking a question is great. And building a relationship is just smiling or just asking, so how's your day going? And then ask the question that you want. Because I think most people in America realize we want to build relationships. We want to make sure that we're building bridges. So with a smile, ask any question you want, but definitely do it with a smile and then with the proper intentions.
Imam?
I think many people are very curious about Ramadan, but they are very, some of them are quite hesitant to just even ask. I think just going and asking a person about fasting, I think Muslims are very excited to share their values of Ramadan, and it'll be very fascinating and a great dialogue for people to sit down and talk about it. So just go ahead and ask someone who's fasting and have them explain what the concept of fasting, charity, and other things that happens in the month of Ramadan, and I think the Muslims will be very excited to explain what it is.
Well, I know it's a couple hours early to say Ramadan Mubarak to you all, but thank you for being with me. Thanks to Aman Sayad Beg with the Islamic Center of the Quad Cities in Moline. I want to thank Mohammed Kaiseruddin, Chairman of Zakat Chicago, and Dilnaz Warich with the Interfaith and Outreach Committee Chair at the Muslim Community Center. We'll have all these links, by the way, if you'd like more information about these organizations at our website at 21stshow.org. But all of you, thank you so much for taking time to be with me today.
Thank you. Honored to be on the show.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to the Equal Rights Amendment in Illinois, the battle's been brewing for decades. It seems, however, that we could be reaching a boiling point. A ratification proposal recently passed the state Senate. It's supposed to go to the House for a vote this week. And while this law, which would ensure that, quote, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex, would just recognize equal rights in Illinois. People around the country on both sides have been paying attention to this. And speaking of both sides, the amendment has been getting bipartisan support in the Capitol. Representative Steven Anderson is a Republican state representative from Illinois' 65th district, which includes Geneva. That's about an hour west of Chicago. He's been a vocal supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment, and he's on the line now from Springfield. Representative Anderson, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I think for many decades, the ERA was something that we associated with feminism, and feminism is something that we associated with the Democratic Party. You're a Republican. Should we be surprised that you've been supporting this amendment?
No, I think that anybody who believes in equal rights and equal rights across the board should not be surprised that both Democrats and Republicans support this bill. It's been too long in coming, quite frankly. And it passed out of the Illinois Senate a few weeks ago, and it passed out with strong bipartisan support. So I'm by no means the only Republican in favor of this.
And so what exactly will this law do?
So the bill will, at long last, give the same protections that other races do, for example, under other amendments of the Constitution, to women. Right now, it's acknowledged by anyone who's involved in a law practice that women do not have the same level of protection, for example, that people of a different color might have. And that's been decided by the Supreme Court that there's a lower level of review for gender-based restrictions, unlike race-based restrictions. And what we're trying to do is make those equal so that women have the same protections as everyone else.
So there are the people who often oppose this say that this is a symbolic and unnecessary measure. There's the, for example, the Illinois Human Rights Act. What's your response to that?
Well, it's absolutely not just symbolic. I mean, it's a wonderful symbol, but it's much more than that. Number one, the Illinois Human Rights Act does not extend to the federal government. So anything that the federal government does preempts local laws and state laws. And so women do not have that protection universally. Also, we're not just talking about Illinois. We're talking about the United States of America. What we're doing is trying to make this a permanent, unchangeable law by virtue of the amendment, so that it applies to everyone, because not every state has a Human Rights Act. Not every state has the equal protection of the laws. So this is something we're doing for everyone, not just for Illinois.
For the whole country, a ratification of this amendment. How do you think the ERA of 2018 is different from that of previous decades, Representative Anderson?
I think that you have to remember, when the ERA originally was proposed, it was 1972. I was 8 years old. And a lot of people between then and now, when I talk to them, assumed it passed. They literally think that it already happened, because why wouldn't it? I think what you see now in 2018 is there's been so much focus on the rights of all people, and certainly with the Me Too movement and the number of sexual harassment and discrimination claims that have been arising, that there's a new, renewed energy, if you will. And I think people recognize the importance of it, because after 37 years or whatever it's been, it's clear that women are not treated equally in so many sectors. I mean, in particular, I always point to the fact that there's a pay discrepancy between women and men. All other things being equal, women make 80 cents on the dollar that men do. And that only gets worse, by the way, if it happens to be a woman of color. That number actually goes down. So it's critically important, and I think that the tenor and the mood of the populace is in favor of this. In fact, most polls that we've done show across the board, Republican and Democrat, easily 80-85% of the people support this concept.
Representative Anderson, what do you think's been misunderstood about the ERA and this ratification and an understanding of it as the debate stands now?
So there are really two areas of huge misunderstanding. One is the context of abortion. The extreme religious right would have you believe that by passing the ERA, that would provide for public funding for abortions. Now, we actually have public funding for abortions in Illinois already, so that really wouldn't change anything here. But the truth is, it has nothing to do with abortion. The only time that would be true is if men could get pregnant and were allowed to have abortions and women couldn't get those same abortions. But obviously, that being a biological impossibility, there's nothing about abortion that has anything to do with this equal rights amendment. So that's the first category of major misunderstanding. And then the other one is that it's going to open the doors literally to everything, to genderless bathrooms, to some of the protections like lactation rooms and things like that have been enshrined lately in laws, that all of those go away. And that's also untrue. The Equal Rights Amendment does not mean that we have to forget that we're male and female. What it means is that there's a stricter review standard for when we impose classifications based on gender. That doesn't mean they all go away. Some of them are necessary and appropriate, but there's a better way of reviewing it than what we have now, and that's under the Equal Rights Amendment.
And Representative, was there a timing of when you expect this is supposed to go to the House for a vote this week?
It's in committee tomorrow morning. We hope that it will fly out of committee, and then it will depend on when Representative Liu Wang, who is the chief sponsor, I'm the chief co-sponsor. It will be decided when he knows that he has the votes. And right now we are working on those votes, and I believe that we're very close, if not there. So it could happen this week, but it may not happen until next week.
That's State Representative Stephen Anderson. He's a Republican from Illinois' 65th district, which includes Geneva, which is about an hour west of Chicago. Representative Anderson, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
We've been talking about the Equal Rights Amendment, and I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation, Ann Schaffley Corey. She's chair of the Eagle Forum. Her mother, Phyllis Schaffley, successfully waged a stop ERA campaign in Illinois in the 70s and 80s. Ann's on the line now from Alton. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And as we were just talking about the ERA passing the Senate, it's not yet been voted on in the House. This is a bill like your mother that you oppose. Why is that?
I oppose it because the language is extreme. It will take away rights and it will harm women. And Representative Anderson is not being quite correct when he says that there will still be gender differences under a federal amendment of the Equal Rights Amendment. There are no exceptions in ERA, no exceptions at all. You cannot, will not be able to make any good natured distinction between men and women if the Equal Rights Amendment passes.
So I guess you're just disagreeing with him on that, because it sounds like he would say the opposite.
Well, the language is quite clear, because ERA does not put women in the Constitution. It puts sex in the Constitution. And sex has many different meanings, but beyond gender. And I don't see how you can possibly, the language is quite clear. There are no exceptions under ERA. And so this will open a wealth of problems if ERA becomes an amendment to the Constitution and has a stronger weight than any state law. So, for example, we will have sex integration of prisons. You won't be able to have a women's shelter where men can't come. An ERA is not going to give any woman a pay raise. An ERA is not going to stop any man from harassing a woman. It will take away true benefits that women have. Women, infants, and children nutrition programs. It will change the benefits for stay-at-home mothers under Social Security. And of course, it will demand equal representation in military combat. There will be gender quotas because ERA makes no exceptions whatsoever. It is a harmful, bad amendment that would cause chaos in the United States.
So, and to be clear, just to understand your position, you think both the Republicans and Democrats in Illinois who supported this would support an amendment that would cause all of the things that you just said would be consequences of this, integrating prisons, for example?
Well, I don't see, the language doesn't have any exceptions to it. So how can you make any sex or gender-based distinction, because the constitutional amendment makes no exceptions?
As we are talking about the history of this, we're talking to Anne Shafley Corey. She's chair of the Eagle Forum based in Alton, Illinois. And obviously, the history of this, as we are we're thinking about the history of this conversation, Illinois was one of the biggest battleground states for your mother, Phyllis Shafley, with her fight against the ERA. And I just wanted to play a little bit of a conversation she had during from this time period that's archived by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
One of the principal reasons we defeated ERA, and maybe the principal reason, is that I defined the battleground that we would fight on. And that battleground was the legal rights that women would lose if ERA passed. And so I showed how it would take away the 18-year-old girl's right to be exempt from the military draft. It would take away the right of a wife to be supported by her husband, which was then, those things are a matter of laws, and what the Equal Rights Amendment would do is to make all the laws sex neutral.
And I just wanted to end by asking you why you think Illinois is such an important hub for this issue.
The battle over the fight on ERA was mostly in Illinois, and the fact that Illinois voters for so many years through the 70s and 80s recognized that we do not want a gender-neutral society, that there are harms and consequences to women if we had put in this kind of language into the Constitution, realizes that this, there are common sense reasons that there are differences between men and women, and we do not want an Equal Rights Amendment which would cause such damage to women across the board. And I'm so happy that the citizens of Illinois recognize that.
That's Anne Shafley Corey. Thank you for being with us, chair of the Eagle Forum based in Alton, Illinois, explaining her opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. I wanted to end this conversation by going to reporter Rachel Otwell. She's been reporting on this for NPR Illinois. She's with me now from their studio in Springfield. Hi, Rachel.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Good morning. As you were listening to hearing clearly the passion that Ann Schaffley Corey was representing on this side of the issue, contrasting that with Representative Anderson, a Republican from Geneva, who supports this. I wonder if that's representative, you think, of what the debate is that will happen within the state house in Illinois over this issue.
Well, I think Representative Anderson hit on it when talking about abortion. I think right now you're seeing a lot of the rhetoric have to do with that. I did speak with a constitutional lawyer who says, you know, that's more of a wild card as far as if it would mandate coverage from the government when it comes to abortion access. But that really seems to be a sticking point as far as the argument right now.
And do you think that this has become maybe in a way, Rachel, I guess, a proxy for other social issues? It sounds like that's a lot of what Ann Schaffley Corey was worried about.
Well, it's a perennial issue, and you touched on earlier why maybe in the wake of the Me Too movement, for instance, it's picking up steam right now. It was drafted all the way back in 1923, however, on the heels of course, the 19th Amendment and women getting the right to vote. Alice Paul, famous suffragist, said this is the next step in women having equality that's codified in the Constitution. And so you just see that this is really brought up. There's a lot of different issues at play that people kind of use this as a platform to talk about.
Let me ask you about the law itself. You spoke to University of Illinois Dean of the Law School and constitutional law scholar Vikram Amar about what's really at stake here. We just heard Ann Schaffley Corey say she's concerned about lots of different effects, whether it's getting rid of benefits and for protections for women to integration of prisons between men and women. Do you have any sense from the law that these interpretations that could result in that?
It's, of course, you can't make total predictions on how something could be interpreted by the Supreme Court, depending on what comes up. But Mar did tell me that, for instance, there are protections now when it has to do with race in the Constitution. And that has not meant that, for instance, the Army has to have total parity when it comes to race, 50%, you know, white, 50% black, or whatever the case may be. That never played out that way. So he says those kind of talks about the draft, about the military, about prison populations, he called that more scare tactics than something that's really based in reality.
I wanted to ask you about the language. It specifies protection on account of sex, not gender. What implications do you see with that?
So the general understanding now is much different than when this was first drafted all the way back in 1923 and even in the 1970s, 1972, when it passed through Congress. Now we consider sex to be more about biology and gender is about someone's presentation, which might not necessarily fall in line with what's on someone's birth certificate. Most people, though, are cisgender, which means their biological sex matches their gender identity. You know, some people are born with ambiguous genitalia. Some people are transgender. For now, though, it seems like people are sticking with the language as is and as it was originally drafted.
That's Rachel Otwell from NPR Illinois. She's a reporter who's been covering this issue closely. Rachel, as we think about this issue, what do you see ahead this week?
It's really hard to tell. You would think that if there had been enough votes in the House, maybe it would have been called before now. So Lou Lang has for years and years tried to drum up the supermajority needed in the House. And so it's tough to tell, but we'll just have to keep our eyes on it and see if those votes come through.
And then if it were to go through in Illinois, Rachel, what's next? Because we heard Representative Anderson talk about this is not just for Illinois, this is for the country. So we need a certain, if you can just give us a quick history lesson here, we just have about a minute left of how much what needs to happen for this to be ratified?
Sure. So Illinois already has almost the exact same language as the ERA in its constitution. Supporters who want this as a federal amendment are focusing on a three-state strategy. So 35 states had passed it, had ratified. They needed 38. That deadline is past us. That happened in 1982. Still, this three-state strategy is going on. Nevada passed last year. So Illinois is one of two more states that haven't ratified that would be needed. And the focus is obviously on Illinois right now to be one of those states. And then from there, it's a whole other question of how the Congress might interpret this.
That's Rachel Otwell with WUIS, NPR Illinois. Thanks for being with us to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment.
Thank you. Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, we saw a high of 90 degrees outside our Urbana studios. And in the summertime, temperatures like that often mean warmer temperatures in our lakes and rivers. This year, though, environmental advocates are worried this will be a banner year for what are called toxic algal blooms. They're not quite the same thing as the algae you're used to seeing, and they're much more dangerous. They're also not tracked by government data. So the Environmental Working Group has been compiling this information themselves in a new report they put out today. We're going to get into what this means for Illinois and the Midwest and check in on the health of our rivers and lakes in general, especially with the Farm Bill currently in Congress and implications for the environment for that. I'm joined now by Craig Cox, who's a Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources with the Environmental Working Group. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you so much.
And with us in our studios in Urbana is Carol Hayes, Executive Director of the Prairie Rivers Network. Carol, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla.
Craig, can you start by describing to us what algal blooms are? Because it's not the same thing as algae we are used to seeing in water in a pool, for example, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, scientifically, the organism is not an algae at all, but is rather called cyanobacteria. But what really sets these organisms apart from normal algae is that they can emit a suite of pretty scary toxins that can have short-term effects ranging from pretty serious flu-like symptoms to liver damage, and over time can be related to cancer from chronic exposure. So they're dangerous.
And how does this form? How is this coming about?
So cyanobacteria are, naturally occurring, but they reach sort of epidemic bloom stages when two things happen. One is the water gets overloaded with phosphorus, which is a fertilizer. You know, that's commonly found in fertilizers applied to agricultural land and to livestock manure. And that fertilizes the algae just like it fertilizes corn. So the growth of the algae really starts to take off, and it grows particularly fast when the water is warmer. So the combination of those two things really triggers these blooms.
My guest is Craig Cox. He's a Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources with the Environmental Working Group. We're talking about a new report that's just out today by the working group. What did you all find, particularly here in Illinois and the Midwest, in the information that you released today, Craig?
Well, as you said in the introduction, there is no really systematic monitoring or reporting of the occurrence of these algal blooms. So what we resorted to is just simply searching for news reports starting in 2010 through 2017. And we found a few news reports in Illinois. The most disturbing one by far was a report back in 2010 that a 12-year-old girl was hospitalized for 3 days with 103-degree fever, nausea, headaches, and a recurring rash after being exposed to the cyanotoxins in Clinton Lake. And the same report indicated that a dog had died after drinking Clinton Lake water on July 4th. In 2017, we found reports that were much less troubling than that report, that Crystal Lake and Urbana was closed in 2017 because of a toxic algal bloom. And in St. Charles, the pond at the dog park was closed because of an algal bloom was threatening health of the dogs in that park. But these blooms, what we found is that these blooms are occurring all across the country. We found news stories of 169 reported blooms in 2017, but I'm sure that is way undercounting the actual occurrence of the blooms, because all we're seeing is ones that generate a news story.
Carol Hayes is also with us as Executive Director of the Prairie Rivers Network. Carol, Craig mentioned Crystal Lake in Urbana. I wonder what you're seeing, your experience with Illinois and water pollution in lakes and rivers, what you all have seen, particularly in the past year?
Well, we know that our surface waters, whether we're talking about lakes or rivers, across the state, many are impaired, whether it's for nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen, or sediment and other kinds of problems. So, as Craig mentioned, while these are naturally occurring in the water, they really result from how we're treating land across the state. With such a large percentage of our land in agricultural production, and because of the types of practices that we use largely on the landscape, where we're not really trying to keep our soils covered, helping to keep those nutrients where they need to be for the crop. Often in heavier rains, we're going to see nutrients passing into our waterways, and that includes our lakes and streams. But even in urban and suburban areas, we need to be aware that we can have these kinds of outbreaks, because nutrients also come from sewage treatment plants. They wash off of streetscapes, off of your lawn. All those sorts of places can also be a source of nutrients and waterways. So this is something that we too are trying to raise attention to. We're a little frustrated that it's hard to get a handle on the kinds of data that we need to really understand the scope and extent of the problem, whether it's worsening. We don't have a very good reporting system at all in Illinois, as most states do not, as Craig mentioned. When I first started at Prairie Rivers that summer, there was an algal bloom that developed on the Ohio River that ended up being 600 miles long and resulted in states that border that river not being able to use the river for recreation or for drinking water. When I called the Illinois EPA to ask how they were informing residents that lived in that area, they didn't have a mechanism to tell folks or warn them that this kind of problem might be where they live, and to take caution.
Carol, is that the 2014? Are you talking about the 2014 outbreak in Toledo particularly?
No, this would have been on the Ohio River. So also in Toledo on Lake Erie, that's another area that's prone to algal blooms. But this is on the Ohio River. And Illinois has 122 shore miles along the Ohio, which stretches from West Virginia all the way down to where it meets the Mississippi.
And so are you satisfied now that there's proper reporting, or what do you think the situation stands as for this summer of 2018?
No, I think Craig is right. This is still an issue where we know that the CDC, for example, is taking note of the increasing number of outbreaks of cyanobacteria and microcystin, which is a toxic algal bloom. And if people report them, then they are tracking them. And then usually it's a report because someone is ill. But often physicians will miss the problem. They'll think it's the flu when it's really a result of exposure to a cyanotoxin. So they may not be accurately testing and reporting. When a report is made, it's our understanding that the EPA has someone in the field check out the problem and determine if it is a cyanobacteria outbreak, in which case they will notify the public by posting signs saying to stay away from the water.
And Craig, just to be clear for folks who are listening, is this cyanobacteria, is this from swimming in lakes? Is this from water consumption? How are people getting sick?
All of the above. You can certainly be exposed to the toxins by drinking water that's contaminated with the toxins. And just to amplify Carol's point, most drinking water utilities are not testing for the presence of cyanotoxins. You can certainly be exposed by swimming. either by just contact with through the skin or by swallowing water, you know, while you're swimming. And in some cases, the toxins can actually volatilize and you can inhale them and be exposed by that route. So there's multiple ways to come in contact with these toxins if they're there.
Craig, I wonder if we could switch gears for a minute and ask you about the farm bill as being debated in Congress. We've been talking on the 21st about various aspects of the bill, including the SNAP program or crop insurance, but conservation programs are also a big part of the farm bill. And can you explain, as it's proposed right now, what it has to do with keeping rivers and lakes clean?
Well, what we're arguing is that it should do a whole lot more about keeping rivers and lakes clean than it's doing today. Taxpayers invest about $5 billion a year that is largely used to pay farmers to try to improve the management of their land to protect water. But we could do so much more by spending that money more wisely, by targeting it and protecting, especially protecting drinking water, than we're doing today. And there's, you know, opportunities to reform the way those programs work to do a much better job. But we also think, you know, farmers get billions of dollars in subsidies a year to support their income. And there is a quid pro quo in the farm bill where in return for subsidies, farmers promise to do a bit to reduce erosion and runoff from their steepest farm fields. But we're arguing that after, you know, that it's time to ask farmers to do just a bit more, especially focused on protecting water as a just a quid pro quo between farmers and taxpayers.
Carol, what would you like to see with the farm bill?
Well, I too would like to see a farm bill that helps support conservation. You know, as I mentioned, 75% of the land in Illinois is in agriculture. That's a lot of landscape that, you know, water washes over and carries nutrients with and is even carrying nutrients into groundwater. We're finding more cases of Illinois communities that are exceeding the amount of nitrates that's allowable in drinking water and having to purchase equipment to remove nitrates. It's very expensive equipment. It's expensive to run. And, you know, we believe that effective conservation practices like keeping cover crops or a living root in the ground or a continuous living cover on the landscape all year round is an important way of reducing the amount of fertilizers like nitrates and phosphorus that are going into our waterways. It's a now recognized practice that doesn't impact yield and is really important for both keeping fertilizer where it needs to be to feed the crop, but also protecting water, not just water quality, but water quantity, so that water is stored where plants need it when they need it most, and returns appropriate functions to soils. So it's while water quality is an extremely important part of conservation, so is protecting the health of our soils and making sure that, you know, they are able to support crops that we rely on to feed us.
Carol, we have less than a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you about what your advice is for folks this summer who may be thinking about swimming and enjoying the lakes and rivers across Illinois. How you think they should be thinking about the water quality of those lakes?
So clearly, as the temperature goes up, you want to be mindful about what's happening in the water that you want to recreate in, especially still water that isn't moving. But watching out for those green sort of pond scum look. You don't want to be in water that has that appearance. And even if you think it may just be regular algae, you don't want to take a risk doing that. We have lots of beautiful rivers in the state, and most of them flow pretty well during the summer. You're always safe in a canoe. And, you know, in moving water is a better idea than perhaps on a very hot day in still water, especially if you see anything green on the surface.
That's Carol Hayes, Executive Director of the Prairie Rivers Network. I want to thank her, along with Craig Cox from the Environmental Working Group. Thank you, both of you, for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You're more than welcome.
That does it for us today. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information, including we'll have that report from the Environmental Working Group. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be sitting down with Susan Burton. She's an activist and founder of an organization called A New Way of Life. For more than 20 years, she's been focused on helping formerly incarcerated women make a better life for themselves once they've been released. Plus, you might know NPR's Sam Sanders from shows like the NPR Politics podcast and his new show. It's called It's Been a Minute. He's going to join us after a live show he's going to be doing in Chicago. Thanks so much for tuning in to the 21st. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.